For a lot of the KC Metro, the Northland doesn't get talked about much unless we're fretting about the airport. But this month's Clay County primary changed that. Businessman Steve West surprised people with his easy win over three other Republican candidates to challenge the Democratic incumbent for Missouri House District 15. That is getting people's attention because Steve West also hosts a weekly radio program under the name Jack Justice. And on that program, he uses a lot of anti-Semitic and Islamophobic rhetoric. So how do the people of Clay County feel about that? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're checking in with Amy Neal, regional news director for the NPG newspapers of the Northland. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
So actually, the political situation in Clay County is kind of wild right now in a lot of ways. We're going to get into some of the other stories in just a little bit, stories people might not have heard. But obviously, the biggie for outsiders is Steve West's recent primary win. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so we had four Republican candidates running for the seat, the Missouri House District 15 seat in the primary, and Steve won, and the Democratic incumbent who this would be his fourth and final term if he's elected in November was also on the ballot. So a lot of people don't pay. Don't do a lot of research into primary candidates, and I don't know if that's the case here.
You think there's a chance people didn't know this about him?
It's possible, but he does have a radio show. It's not under his given name, but people do know him as a businessman, as a former realtor. So I mean, people may have known him and may not have known where he stood. And the reason I say that they may not have known is that the Northland that I'm familiar with, some of the views that he is that he voices just aren't in sync with the Northland that I'm familiar with, or the Northland that I know. But I will say that John Carpenter, as the Democrat, was unopposed, and there were still more than 3,700 votes for him. In the Republican primary, there was somewhere around 3,000 votes total. And
with a divided pool like that, it could just be that he amassed, that even do the other three candidates put together, do they come close if you do it that way to?
Steve West got 49% of the the vote in the Republican primary. So the other three added up, were about where he's at on his own. He was listed first on the ballot. Statistically, those candidates tend to do better.
That's so weird.
It is. But it happens. So I don't know. there's a lot of things that happen in the Northland that I would say promote diversity or promote understanding of things that are different than us. There's an organization called Hate Busters that originated in the Northland, and their philosophy is, we're going to help you learn to like people who aren't like you, and we have, the Fellowship of the Concerned, which is based in Liberty, which has been promoting unity and cultural understanding since I think it was the 60s that it was founded, and it's still going strong. So it's sort of surprising to me that somebody with when we asked the candidates questions before the primary, we have a candidate who responded with some homophobic as well as, Islamophobic comments, that is somebody who, voters got behind. And so I don't know if they were aware of those views before they went to the polls or not.
The Clay County GOP has issued a statement rebuking this candidate. It reads as follows: Steve West's shocking and vile comments do not reflect the positions of the Missouri Republican Party or indeed of any decent individual. West's abhorrent rhetoric has absolutely no place in the Missouri Republican Party or anywhere. We wholeheartedly condemn his comments. Republican State Rep. Kevin Corlew, who represents a neighboring district in the Northland, has also distanced himself from Steve West, seemed genuinely surprised by his win. It is an interesting thing. Do the people of Clay County, Democrat or Republican, kind of feel the need to say, hey, this doesn't represent us?
Well, I would say since we've had some people, you know, come out and say, no, he's not with us. I would say,
and
yes.
Even you, it seems like, are saying this doesn't represent the community I know.
Or that's absolutely right. But he is someone who has an ongoing radio show. So, you know, there must be an audience. You know, it's hard. Hard as a journalist. You know, you know. Very pro First Amendment, very pro people, you know, sharing their views, whatever they may be. But at the same time, as a resident of the Northland, being disappointed that it isn't a more inclusive viewpoint.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting thing when so much of what you're hearing is people saying that it doesn't represent them. You do win an election by getting votes. It's a confusing situation.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. You know, and I think that, you know, I read in a news story, someone from the Republican Party, I think it was the state I don't know if it was at the county or state level, but talking about, well, we didn't invest a lot of resources or we didn't really investigate some of these candidates that were at the primary ballot at this level. And so I don't know if it's just a lack of you know, maybe it underscores that across the board, voters, even the parties, maybe need to be looking into those candidates a little bit more.
Is this a situation for you as both a journalist in the Northland and a Northland resident where mm-hmm. it might be nice if Kansas City as a whole had been paying attention before this result came to light? Just for context.
That's hard to answer. I mean, I will say as a journalist, my experience is that, and I've been a journalist in Clay County for, you know, 13 or 14 years, something like that. So I've been through quite a few election cycles. And, you know, we get the most calls and the most inquiries about the ballot the week before the vote. And, you know, at a weekly newspaper, sometimes that ship has sailed, you know, whatever coverage we're going to do by the time people are really reaching out to us.
You don't even have another issue between then and the election necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I will say, you know, for our part, we put out a couple newspapers in the Northland, the Courier Tribune and the Gladstone Dispatch. And, you know, before the general elections, we try to do some candidate forums to help help keep people informed. And this definitely makes us think about, well, what do we need to do before a primary? Is there something we could do to help educate people more? And but you also have to have people come seek that information out.
Well, like I said, this is just one of the dramatic political stories unfolding in Clay County right now.
Yeah.
The people have petitioned for an audit of their government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is really a pretty amazing thing. I mean, I guess the fact that people want accountability in government, that may not be so earth-shattering. But over the past year, a group that eventually organized as the Citizens for a Better Clay County, they got more than 9,000 signatures to ask for a state audit of Clay County government. And they needed something like 5,500 signatures. So they went above and beyond. Those signatures, it has to be, you know, almost 6,000 registered voters of Clay County in order to initiate that audit. But and so those signatures are being validated right now. You know, what I'm hearing is that they don't doubt that there will be enough valid signatures to initiate that. And so
what inspired it? What is it that people want to know about their government?
Yes. So there are kind of three things that the petitioners said over and over again, that they are looking for more transparency in government. They want to address what they see as wasteful spending in government, and they also want to see increased responsiveness when they bring their concerns to their government. And it's interesting to note that something like 70 current and former elected officials, both at the city level throughout the county, at the county level, both sitting and former elected officials, and at the state level, signed this petition. So it's not just citizens. It's also, you know, politicians, people involved in government. And the presiding commissioner in Clay County is up for election this year. The incumbent made it through the Republican primary, and now he faces a challenge from a political newcomer from the Democratic Party. But both of them signed the petition. So they're both... you know, to some degree, on the same page. But we have a three-person commission in Clay County. So we have one commissioner who signed that petition, two who did not. And so that's kind of an interesting dynamic. Since those signatures were turned in, the county administrator also has resigned. So that was about a month ago and, you know, didn't list a specific reason. Another county administrator has not been named yet. There's three assistant county administrators who are kind of taking care of things, you know.
This is quite a shakeup. Is there a larger story about either change in the county or what is there an underlying explanation that you can detect or no, it's just something we'll be figuring out for years to come.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a work in progress in figuring out, you know, because when you have an elected government, it changes with the people. It changes with the people who are voting. You know, in Clay County, I will say we see a lot of the same names on the ballot, not always for the same office, but we see a lot of the same names on the ballot, and so, we have the same pool of voters. I mean, the pool changes to some degree, but we have the same pool of voters voting the same people in, whether it's the same office or not. So so I think it really just depends. Although I will say, you know, within the current Clay County government, there are some folks who are very supportive of the idea of having the state auditor come in and take a look at things. A state audit isn't a financial audit. It's a performance audit. So they look at things like Sunshine Law compliance, which is open records, open meetings compliance. They look at processes, you know, do you have the right checks and balances, as well as just looking at those numbers. You know, I think when most people hear audit, they immediately think money, and a state audit would be more than that.
So something else that has gotten some attention within Clay County mm-hmm. is a gender-neutral bathroom in a Clay County school.
Yeah. So in the North Kansas City School District, which... Before I walked in here, I could have told you what the enrollment of the district was, but it's a very large district. Four high schools, four middle schools, two sixth grade centers, and you know more than a dozen elementary schools. And they built two new elementary schools over in the past year to deal with growth in the district, but they're doing a lot of construction elsewhere in the district. But a couple years ago, when they opened the Northland Innovation Center, which houses the district's gifted program, they constructed bathrooms that are neither boys' bathrooms or girls' bathrooms. They're bathrooms, and so there's a common area with a sink, and you know, in the mirror and things like that, and then off to the side are the stalls are not, you know, those metal stalls that, you know, you can see, you know, people's feet and, you know, you could throw something over the top. But it's actually, you know, a floor-to-ceiling wall with a floor to, you know, with a door that fills the whole frame.
So more privacy.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I would love it if all bathrooms were like that. But going in, and so the kids have privacy, but the teachers who are monitoring these kids, if you're a female teacher, you know, about half your class is girls, half is boys. But you can't go in the boys' bathroom. But this allows the teachers to kind of monitor what's going on a little bit better. It gives the kids more privacy. But also, you don't have to choose what bathroom you're going into. You just go in there. And so these new facilities that have been built, they also have that bathroom structure.
How are people responding to that?
You know, I haven't heard a single a single negative. You know, I know my daughter when she goes to school and she uses that bathroom, she likes it a lot. And it comes down to the privacy issue that, you know, she doesn't have to, you know, as a kid, you can be very shy.
There are a lot of different currents in this political stream.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And, you know, going back to the beginning, you know, saying that, you know, some of the views that this one candidate is sharing doesn't align with the Northland I know, because, you know, what I'm living in every day is these opportunities to include more people and serve more people, you know, and just be inclusive. And so,
Amy Neal, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Amy Neal is the regional news director for NPG Newspapers in the Northland, and this conversation is part of an ongoing series on Central Standard, checking in with community newspapers. Speaking of which, we are about to take on media literacy in 2018. How do you make sense of the headlines? 816-235-2888. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we are living in interesting times. A lot of people don't know whether to believe the news or what news to believe, which means they don't know how to make sense of their world. So Lewis Duguid, a former Star reporter of many years, has made it his mission to improve what he calls media literacy in Kansas City. Lewis, good morning.
Hi, Gina.
How do you define media literacy?
I think it's people being aware through consuming many different types of media just what the intent of the news and entertainment might be that's coming at them so much. So many people think of the media as being benign, just something that's there for them to enjoy and absorb. But in so many cases, it's not benign. There's a hidden message. There is something else, some ulterior motive that's implanted in the media to direct them towards some end that a corporation or a company or some bias might have an intent for them.
Can you give an example?
Yes. In many cases, when people might watch programming on television, they'll see just a program that's for entertainment, but implanted in that program might be an ad that's embedded for them to see that this particular actor or actress drinks a particular type of Coke or wears a particular type
product
of clothing.
Placement.
Yeah, the product placement is huge. But there's also, I think, implanted in the media a certain set of standards of how we dress, how we look, what type of makeup people might wear. And that's just on television. But when you look at stories that are in a particular newspaper, it can be national, local, you have to wonder why was that approach taken? Why was that particular element highlighted? And so the program that I'm going to do at the Woodneath Library this evening will just try to heighten people's awareness of these things that are put in the media to get them to shift one way or the other.
You know, I am a little bit surprised to hear someone who has been a part of the world of journalism decrying the media and its nefarious agendas.
Well, I'm not going to be like Trump and say that the media are nefarious. I want to get people to think. I think it's important, and throughout my journalism career at The Star and in other places, it's been directed at giving people information so that they can be more informed as citizens of this country. And it's so critically important to have an informed citizenry so that when individuals go to the polls, they will pick the person who best represents the interests of the community that they're in.
So you, it sounds to me like you are drawing a distinction between journalism and the media, in that journalism is a subset of this larger thing called the media.
Journalism is a subset, you're absolutely right. But the media overall, I think, do have an effect on the public. They have an effect on how we view the world, because the media speak into our lives more than anything else. The media help to socialize our children more than parents or schools. And I think that it's important for people to realize that we are constantly consuming the media, and that is not to just pick it up because it's there for us to just enjoy. But the media are there to promote a product, to push a particular idea or agenda. But the agenda of individuals is to try to be as informed as they possibly can so that they can make better choices. Here in the Kansas City area, people absolutely should read the Kansas City Star. They should absolutely listen to KCUR because each provides people with a different stream of information that helps them to become a better citizen, a better citizen of this community, and to also be able to invest their resources, money and time, in ways that benefit the overall community.
Lewis, you are looking at a stack of newspapers that you have kind of like spread out in front of you. And I feel that there is a point that these are here to make, and I'd like to know what that is. What are these newspapers about?
Well, in today's Kansas City Star, I went back to page 9A, and if you read the story on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh by President Trump, you'll see in the first leg of type down toward the bottom what I find troubling, because it is editorializing in what's supposed to be a news story. News stories are supposed to present the facts. But in this case, a story pulled from the New York Times, it says Kavanaugh drew up the memo as other members of Starr's team were preparing to question Clinton. The memo, dated August 15, 1998, was shot through with disgust for Clinton's behavior. That shot through with disgust for Clinton's behavior, and it goes on, is editorializing.
So you're saying some actions were interpreted as disgust.
Absolutely. And that really indicts what the writer is trying to get across as being more his opinion versus information that's provided to the reader. What could have happened and what should have happened is there's a quote that follows later that really is pulled from Kavanaugh's memo that defines that disgust. In journalism and in journalism schools, we're taught you don't hammer people with your opinion, but just give them the facts. Let them make their own opinion of what's going on. And I think that the intent here is something different. And people, if they're informed, can see that there's editorializing here, and they can also either accept the story because it conforms with their view or dismiss it as being something that's not right.
Certainly the journalists at the New York Times are trained journalists who have heard the same lessons you're repeating here. Do you think that there are pressures on journalists to do what you're pointing out here, or is there some other explanation?
Graduating from the University of Missouri, Columbia School of Journalism, we are hammered to keep our opinions out of news stories. Now, of course, if you're writing opinions, which I did for 30 years at the Kansas City Star, that's different. But as a journalist, as a reporter, as a photographer, as a copy editor, as an editor, you're trained to pull these things out or make it so that people can just get the information and, again, form their own opinion. Some people, however, put this stuff in, and it again indicts the credibility of the writer of the publication. But it also sets off people like President Trump, who begin to say that that's fake news and there's an agenda. And so journalists really can't afford to cross a line so that it creates these problems.
It sounds to me like you want to lead a workshop for journalists. It's interesting to me that this is something you're doing in a workshop for the public. What is it that a reader or consumer of news gains by understanding the things you're talking about here?
Well, I think that the public needs to be as aware as people are going through journalism schools of what should be the outcome of the media that they're consuming, so that when they see that it's veered off the path, they can then make a correction. You know, when I was
or just judge that credibility for themselves,
or find different information that gives them the news without it being tainted. When I was at Harvard University last year in the Nieman Visiting Fellowship, we talked about this extensively, and I think that that's the kind of conversation that folks need to have in order to be better consumers.
Well, I'm curious about what the listeners out there do want to know, and whether the current media landscape is confusing for people, whether it's changing their news consumption habits. Call 816-235-2888. Lisa Rodriguez is also with us. She's the evening newscaster here at KCUR. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Gina.
It's interesting to me, as a younger journalist, how do you hear Lewis's comments?
I think there's a lot of value and a lot of truth to what he's saying. And I think that in the last few years, a lot of different media organizations have had to take a step back and look at their organizations and find out, like, what is our identity? What kind of an organization are we? Are we someone who, you know, are we a watchdog? Are we the resistance? Are we, you know, and make those decisions. And maybe a paper like The Times has decided we're on the defense here. And that certainly can change the way that they, you know, that they make decisions, or change the language that they use. At KCUR and at NPR, we have not taken necessarily that stance. So we have to be really careful about
stand with the facts.
Right.
Really motto.
Careful. You know, if I were to, you know, write or ascribe some, you know, emotion into that writing and say, you know, the memo was disgusting, I think a good editor would say, who said it was disgusting? How can you say it was? How can you prove it was disgusting? And if you have a quote that says that, then that's the way that you're going to take. But I think each, media outlets have kind of had a reckoning of who we are and what is our job.
You are in an interesting position of quickly vetting stories to see if they should make it into a daily news cycle for our listeners. And you're combing a lot of different sources and making those decisions. So you are both a news consumer evaluating credibility and a news source distributing information,
right?
A gatekeeper who decides what people will and won't hear, and a sharer who puts the information out there. Can you talk about how you deal with these issues Lewis is describing in that unique position?
Well, certainly it's not something to take lightly. I feel a lot of pressure from it every day, because I have to think, specifically in this situation, I'm in a city that is in two different, that crosses state lines, that has so many different jurisdictions in this metro area, and I have to think for each story who's affected by this information, who needs this information the most. Is it, you know, everyone on the Kansas side? Is it a statewide story? Is it Kansas City, Missouri City Hall? And if I have too many stories on that, is Lenexa missing out? So there's this, so there's, you know, a regional decision. And then I also know that I have very valuable real estate. I've got a minute and 40 seconds. So if I, you know, when I'm stacking a newscast, sometimes I might leave one story out just so that I have a better blend of stories and you know, regions and parts of the city. And is it too much politics? And do people need a moment of joy and need to hear about, you know, an art or someone's first day of school? And, you know, right now I feel like with the fire hose of news every day, I also have to think of people's mental state and I don't want them to turn it off because it's all bad.
Well, I have a question for you about this issue of credibility, too. I mean, you have to evaluate the credibility right. of your sources.
Right.
Among your sources, I would say other news sources is part of that, but so is social media and a lot of other things. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's a lot of what I do every afternoon. If you walk by my desk at any point in the day, I do have Twitter and Facebook up all the time, as well as my traditional news sources. And I've got maybe five different columns of things that I'm watching for all the time. And some of that's other news outlets, but I have to be really careful about that. If I see a news outlet tweet a piece of information that seems to me like a breaking news story, that's when I have to do my due diligence and follow up and confirm it for myself.
As like the digital world, I mean, I'm interested in your two perspectives on the digital world, partly because of the generational split between you, but then the shared viewpoint that you both have as journalists who are really not espousing truthiness as some sort of gray area. So, yeah, Lisa, I'll start with you. As social media becomes part of the media, how does that affect the way you think people are consuming news and understanding credibility in news?
I think it's made it a bigger challenge. There's the internet and social media has made it so that anyone can break news, not just a news outlet. And we have also seen a proliferation of news sources that are coming to us from every angle. And so it's not only the consumer's job to decide which source is a credible source. It's also happening in the moment as it happens. And as we know, things change over the course of time. What may appear to be one thing in one instant may be a totally different thing 5 minutes later. So there's a lot of juggling that goes on there. So for me as a consumer, I've tried to filter and decide, you know, what are my posts for what is good? What outlets do I know that I trust? What outlets do I know I trust, but I know lean a little bit to the left? What outlets do I find credible, but I know also have their own bias? And I have, you know, kind of guideposts so that I know how to know that what I'm reading is valuable and is true.
Social media will push the established press to do stories that they may not have done in the past. But it is, I think, the responsibility of the established press to verify, because in so many cases, what social media sites might post as being legitimate news is absolutely false. I had seen something on Facebook posted as a legitimate story of some celebrity who had died. And I was shocked that this person had passed and there was no news on it. Well, go to the legitimate websites, nothing, and so dismissed it. When Ron Dellums, a former House of Representatives member, passed, social media picked it up first. And then it was verified by the Mercury News in California, and that was the day of. But it's important that the mainstream media pick up on these stories when they are occurring, or at least verify that it's real or fiction.
Lisa, I'm curious. We've heard what Lewis's big concerns are about media literacy. What about you? I mean, what do you think news consumers, by and large, don't understand about how journalism works, but probably should?
I guess my biggest concern, at least, you know, in the time that we're living in now, is people insulating themselves and reading just what they want to read and reaffirming their own opinions and seeking out the sources that do that. Because we also, you know, living in a social media world, once we show a pattern of what we like to read, we know that Facebook is now takes note and is curating that for you, as does Twitter. And so it takes what your preferences are and your opinions are, and then it feeds you more of that. And I really think that that has changed, you know, our discourse. We cannot see the other side if we don't know the other side, and we're refusing to accept what both sides are. And when you're reading, I think one of the basic tenets of journalism is when you're reading an article, you should see this side says this, the other side says this. And you should, that balance should be not just in what you're reading, but in the sources that you're getting it from.
And it's not just the social media sites, but Fox, MSNBC, each has a slant. And that slant creates a bias, and people who consume only those shows come away with a certain mindset. And it's important for folks to get a different mix from different media sources, and reading really is number one.
Well, just to play devil's advocate, you've talked about the red flags of credibility, and a lot of people might say, I have tuned out a source that where I saw too many of those red flags.
And tuning out is part of the problem. People should remain open and aware, because you don't know what you don't know. And it's from newspapers and information being edited by people who are professionals, that they can get more information. For example, in the Kansas City Globe.
We're going to have to get back to that example, Lewis. Call 816-235-2888 to get in on this conversation about media literacy with veteran journalist Lewis Duguid and KCUR newscaster Lisa Rodriguez. We will be taking those calls in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about media literacy in 2018 with Lisa Rodriguez and Lewis Duguid. Hi again, you guys.
Hey.
Hi.
Now, Lewis, as we went to break, you were just beginning to cite an example of a trend you see in journalism and the consumption of journalism.
Well, I want to let people know that it's important to consume many and different types of media. For instance, in the Kansas City Globe, a weekly black newspaper, recent edition, there's an article about a diversity and inclusion breakfast and awards program that the Kansas City Chamber had. And that wasn't in the Kansas City Star that I recall, and I didn't see it anywhere else, but it is mainstream news nevertheless that people need to know about, but they have to consume the media such as the Globe in order to find out. In the Kansas City Call, there in this latest edition, there's an article that on the Kansas City Health Department coming up with data on life expectancy in the different councilmanic districts. It's lower in the black districts versus being higher in the white districts. And again, that's mainstream news that we wouldn't have known about had it not been for researching and seeing these things in the black press. Or Melissa Robinson, who's chair of the Kansas City School Board, running for a city council seat. Never had I seen that anywhere else, but it's important to know that these things are a part of our community so that we are informed.
Has this always been the case that we've had to seek out so many different news sources to piece together what you might call mainstream news, or is something changing?
No, this has always been the case. It's very vital for citizens of this community to not only consume the Kansas City Star and read it and for all the information that's there, but also to pick up Dos Mundos, the Kansas City Hispanic News, the Call, and the Globe, so that they can get a good understanding of what the different elements of our community are about. It's important, especially as the diversity of this community changes and we become more a community of color.
Let's talk to John in Grandview. I want to say John called 816-235-2888, and you can do that too, to talk about whether your attitudes toward the media have changed, if controversy around journalism has affected the way you consume the news, and if you feel more informed or less, more involved in vetting your news sources or less. 816-235-2888. John in Grandview, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I myself am a graduate of the University of Missouri Columbia School of Journalism. A question I have for all three of you is, objectivity a myth in journalism? Is it possible to be objective? Is the presentation of facts itself a subjective decision?
There's okay, a big question, but thank you, John.
There's a huge debate about that. There is no objectivity because you have a person, an individual, who has to decide what's the most important information that is in a story, and then to put that first, and then what's the second most important to put that second, and so forth on down the line. But the individual who's the reporter also is charged with providing different sides so that people viewing the story can form their own opinion about what matters most, who may be right, who may be wrong, and it's up to the individual.
But wouldn't you say, I just devil's advocate again, that that's part of why there are, like, rules and journalistic ethics.
And editors.
And editors, like checks and balances within a newsroom.
Always.
And so something like the firewall between advertising and journalism.
And that circulation.
Those are rules, like church and state kind of thing, that keep some of these decisions out of the hands of individuals.
Absolutely. And you have to go back to the progressive era in this country. Before the progressive era, which gave us the Senate being elected by popular vote, the federal income tax to take care of the needs of people in communities where they weren't being served, journalism also went through its change. To become more professionalized, to take journalism from a craft and make it a profession so that individuals actually had to go to journalism schools. 1908 was the first journalism school college in the country, and that was at the University of Missouri. We are very fortunate in this area to have fabulous schools of journalism, the University of Missouri being one, University of Kansas another, and Kansas State. And again, readers in this area are also fortunate to have many graduates from those programs actually working in the media throughout Missouri and Kansas.
I also think we've been talking about the rules and the training for journalists, but I think that there are certain practices that reporters and journalists can do to make sure that to kind of weed out that subjectivity, to make yourself more objective. And part of that is learning where your own biases are, whether that's political, whether that's certain people you like to talk to. And some of that is kind of looking back at your own work and say, how many people have I talked to this person? Look, checking my sources. How many times in the last month did I talk to this one person for a certain amount of stories? How many of my stories were in this community versus another community? And whereas that can be uncomfortable to look at yourself because you think you're a journalist, I'm objective, I see the world objectively, but we're also humans and humans don't see the world objectively. So recognizing that in yourself makes it easier to push back and see where your tendencies are. Now, I can't say that as a consumer, you trust every reporter to do that, but I think that's our job to do as well.
So it's in partly the number of different voices and subjective realities you're putting together to develop your picture of what the truth is.
Right.
And that's really vital, because the more you have different people with a diverse background, the more likely it is that a newspaper, radio station, television station, social media will be able to deliver to people news that doesn't have bias in it.
You know, something that we have not really talked about yet is another perspective on what media literacy even means. As a journalist, I think about who knows how to leverage the media and who doesn't, and how that affects what stories get told. And Lisa, I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit.
As far as, I guess I might need you to clarify a little bit.
What kind, like the communities that are able to frequently get their stories
right.
told, and communities who might have more trouble accessing the voice of the media, if you will.
That's a real challenge and a big issue as well, because those with the means will be the most visible and will be the most heard. And so that, you know, that those stories will... they will be part of the mainstream media. They will be part of the story. And I think that when, you know, a news organization decides, you know, what stories and whose stories we're going to tell, they have to make that extra effort. They have to double that effort to get to those communities and those people whose stories aren't naturally going to be told. And it's a constant battle, because that's a lot harder.
For you, I mean, as a bilingual reporter, I find that you've been able to tell stories that news organizations staffed with fewer bilingual reporters maybe wouldn't notice.
It's a big opportunity for me, and I have to continue to try and be in those communities and tell those stories. And a reaction that I have gotten out on interviews in Spanish is this question: well, why do you want to talk to me about this? Why is it important that you're here talking to me about this? And that is a question that you wouldn't get in a different community, in City Hall. It's assumed, like, well, of course you want to talk to me about this. And so explaining that, you know, I want to tell your story because I think people don't know about it, and I think other people would really identify with this story.
The Black and Latino communities have been left out of so much of the mainstream media coverage that people are not only as aware that they should be included, but they're leery about being included. So it's important that you have journalists who are able to break the ice, to be able to go in and do those pieces in a fair and accurate way, so that it creates more opportunities for people of color to be able to get into the news. On your point about who makes the news, it's really critical for journalists to be aware that the people with money and power have the most access to the press, because they're able to hire public relations people who can advise them and put together news releases that are crafted so it gets the attention of journalists. And we have to, in the news industry, be aware that, those are important, but so are the stories of people who don't have that ability.
So when you teach workshops on media literacy, it seems like that is an argument for how media literacy could benefit a member of the public, understanding the media in order to access the media.
Absolutely.
With your stories.
Absolutely. I've done workshops nationwide on accessing the media and how to do it, how to acquire phone numbers, how to look for reporters' work that might be structured so that they can see that individual would be interested in their story.
Let's hear from Mike before we go. Mike is calling us from Shawnee with a particular concern. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Gina. I know you don't have much time left, so I'll be brief. I am a big believer in the law of unintended consequences, and I've spent my career in the cable television business, although, by the way, I did graduate from KU's journalism school. But the unintended consequence here in the cable industry, as well as the newspaper business, is that large national corporations have been buying up local papers and local cable systems for decades. And every new buyer thinks they can run it more efficiently and save money with fewer staff and so forth. And what they've ended up, and the Kansas City Star, in my opinion, has done the same thing, is they've traded a lot of $70,000 and $80,000 and $90,000 a year editors, senior people who've been there for 30 years, who've seen everything, for 23-year-olds just out of school, and paid them a third as much. And they just aren't inculcated with this fairness thing.
Well, let's
got to weed out.
We're anyway, short on time, so I want to get some reaction.
There has to be a balance of people who are veterans and people who are new. The newer staff are able to discern what news should be for newer, younger people.
As closer to the 23-year-old, Lisa, perhaps anything you want to say about this?
Not that much closer, but I'll say I agree. It's really important to have that balance and for your newsroom to look as different as you want your readership to be.
Well, Lisa Rodriguez, PM newscaster here at KCUR, thanks for stopping by.
Of course.
And Lewis Duguid, thank you.
It's always a joy. Thank you.
Lewis is leading a workshop on media literacy tonight at 7 at the Woodneath branch of the Mid-Continent Public Library. And if you can't make it there, you can keep talking to us about it on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. That's a wrap for today. If you missed something from the show and want to catch up, we have today's conversations online at kcur.org/centralstandard. They'll be there ready for you later today. And you can also subscribe to all these conversations like a podcast. Listen to them, get them sent to you. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and Kathleen Pointer. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.